Matrix. I'm Jonathan, and I'm left of center.
And I'm Rich, and I tend to lean a little bit more to the right. But the bottom line is together we try to look for the balance of what it means to be human in today's world.
So let's get started. Welcome to Living in the Matrix. I'm Jonathan. My co-host Rich is not here today. He is in fabulous Greece, so I'm a little jealous. Today we have a fabulous guest. Yeah. And I found her because I was reading a book and her name was mentioned as part of some work in Psychology Today for an article around men's mental health. And I read the article and was really kind of blown away. And I thought, let's invite her on. And she said yes. So welcome, Karima. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start with the article, Men Need More Than Ice Baths and Podcasts. Help our listeners understand the point and intention of the article, because I'd love to dive into it with you.
Well, the article came to me and my co-author, Mark Shelvock, when we were grappling with thinking about, okay, there's this culture right now of ice baths and podcasts, and mm-hmm. that tends to be where a lot of men stop. They can do this amazing work of, you know, sitting in an ice bath for and keep, you know, doing their time limits and how long they can stay in it, and they're willing to do that kind of discomfort work. But part of me was like, what about the emotional discomfort that we're all in? Like, how long can you sit in that? And so we started playing around with that, and we really wanted to create an invitation for men to try applying those skills to their emotional world and their inner world.
And so what did you do research for the article, or was it kind of an encapsulation of what you had learned?
It was a integration of so many facets of what I do.
Okay, so what would you consider beyond the ice bath and podcast? Because I believe men are attracted to those two things. One, because they're both very physical. Mm-hmm. I've learned the more that I listen and do this, the more that I call my own bullshit. And because it's recorded, like I have it out there, my ideas are out there. So I can't be as, it requires a lot of integrity to do a podcast. And ice baths are that hard physical thing. So help us see beyond that of what you're talking about.
Okay. So I work with a lot of men in therapy, and I almost consider it like doing weight classes when they're working with their emotions. I love shadow work. I love this. The idea of the shadow is that, you know, there's parts of ourselves we're not willing to see, and there's positive shadow and negative shadow. Positive shadow are the amazing parts that we don't see in what we're doing. And the, you know, negative shadows, things we're trying to hide that, you know, might make us afraid. And the more we can tolerate discomfort, the more we are willing to take down our armor and our masks and our cultural toxic messages and, you know, get beyond shame and get beyond, like, that requires big muscles, big emotional muscles. And like, it can be quite uncomfortable for people who start out. They might be at the 10 pound weights, mm-hmm. you know, and working those for like a year or and then they move up to the 20 pound weights and they're like, wow, that actually wasn't, what I thought was hard is no longer hard to me. And then right. you can keep building these skills and these tools. And on all of a sudden, you're just like a heavyweight. You're an Olympian when it comes to the inner world. So that whatever arises in you, you're like, okay, all right. I know what this is. I know what to do. So that's what I'm meaning. I'm meaning like how we dip into the bad lands of the inner world.
So what does that look like for you? In terms of men think visually, what does that look like in terms of experience? So men can kind of grab onto that of what, because I know what you mean, but I want to draw that out in terms of how does a man who's interested in improving his life, dig into the internal world. What does that look like?
Well, it often first requires a safe container. And so nobody's meant to do this kind of work alone. It's great to have someone very safe that you trust that can create a space where you're willing to maybe take off some of the armor and like start. So one of the things I talk about is becoming your own scientist and getting really curious with what's going on. Like here, something just bubbled out of me. Something just arose. I'm not really sure what it is. I have a weird reaction or a strong reaction. I'm not really sure what it is. You put on your scientist glasses. I don't even know what are you wearing as a scientist. And your microscope. You take out your microscope and you start zooming in and getting really curious and start doing data collection. You can start collecting data on yourself and do it, writing memos and being like cataloging it. And then you get really, you start putting this puzzle together of who am I and what's going on? And why did I do this? And what, like, and you build this amazing map of your life, which is power. That is powerful. When you are able to identify, like, you'll just know, you're like, oh, actually I collected this on May 17th. And mm-hmm. You start just having concrete data on who you are and why you do what you do and what's going on.
Well, I think the interior is, for a lot of men, could be a very dark space. They don't know what's there. Mm-hmm. And don't like to look like failures. It's kind of an Achilles heel for men, is that we don't like looking stupid because mm-hmm. men are primarily up here. And, you know, women can get down in their body a lot more easily. And I think that's an extremely valuable asset. I learn so much from the women in my life because they can feel a lot easier than men. And I think for men, going inside starts with not wanting to look stupid. And I think that's the value of the Ice Baths and the podcast, is their beginning stages. But like you said, to go deeper, have you ever heard of Ed Brighton?
No.
Ed Brighton was a football player. I think he played for New England Patriots. And he started a podcast. And he's this burly football guy, 6'7". But he's doing the journey of going inward. And it blows my mind every time I hear him, because what he realizes it comes down to is, if I go inward, I've got to deal with myself. And I don't like mm-hmm. doing that. Mm-hmm. And he talks about it as a journey of what it means to go inside, is I've got to first deal with, I don't like parts of myself. And that's hard to look at. So how do you deal with that? Mm-hmm. Or how would you counsel people to deal with that?
I love that you're bringing this up. It's such an important point about the way men have been socialized and conditioned is different than the culture women are in and their freedom to share their emotions. They have some very oppressive norms that they're trying to figure out and move through, and especially around looking weak or having a chink in their armor and not like the collude in a culture of silence about how much emotional pain they're in. And I've been privileged in that I've been able to witness people, men, get more comfortable in these spaces, you know, since working at distress centers in Canada, where I'm from, and where I really got to see behind the masks and see, especially when men get to the brink, like the edge of, do I want to be here or not? Like if they have suicidal ideation, like I mm-hmm. have been with men in the pits of hell, of their own hell. And how do you feel safe? Like, how do we create options? How do we create safety in those moments so that things that might seem like completely awful, it actually is so helpful when we can name them and create a safe space to figure out what's going on here? What is going on here? You're definitely not alone in it. And just putting it on like the table as something to explore as this scientist. Let's get really curious. And there's so much work to remove the toxic programs that are on top of men in terms of like shaming them. It's actually the hardest thing to do is get vulnerable. Those are the most courageous people I have ever met, are the strongest people I've ever met. So it's correcting that cultural narrative that like, as long as you look like you have no chinks in your armor, you are strong. No, actually the strongest men I know.
The paper tiger sometimes is more valuable, you know?
Exactly. So it's doing these corrective messages to what's been like, you know, it's been really hard to break this pattern and this cycle of like, it's inherited from, you know, father to son, and it just keeps going down of like, we don't talk about things. We don't talk about weakness. We don't have hard feelings. Yeah. And so it's making it safe enough that we can put things on the table. That's the power of shadow work. We can put the ugliest thing on the table and find a way to love it, find a way to figure it out, find a way to find its place, to reap the lessons and like figure, like just know it, where to put it, how to integrate it. So it no longer holds that same charge. Because often men come to me haunted. They come to me haunted. They are just like, I don't know how I'm going to be able to keep going. I every day think about X, Y, Z. And then doing the work, getting through the work, the power of like creating the safe space to figure it out. By the time we figured it out, you know, it might be a year, it might be 2 years, it might be, it's different for everyone, but it no longer holds power. So what makes me love what I do is when I can have it like somebody, we start a session and they're haunted by XYZ, and by, you know, a certain point later, that it's a non-issue. It's they're just like, it doesn't even matter anymore. That's amazing.
A lot of people don't understand what that feels like though, because it's, you know, people have certain fears in their life, and it's easier to compartmentalize and ignore fear than it is to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And the problem is that when we compartmentalize, it means we're storing it inside of our body somewhere, and it will create disease. And it's interesting that people can accept the disease when it actually, this is the thing that gets me, is the moment we face the fear, we realize we could always overcome it, but we just had to face it in order to discover that. Mm-hmm. And people don't have the discovery to know its value until they face their fear. Because that was my journey. I spent the last 30 years trying to figure out why I couldn't face my fears. And what I eventually realized is that I could, I just didn't know it yet. And I think work is, in a lot of ways, discovering your potential of what's already there. I've always had the capacity to face the fear. What do you see when you work with men that helps them get over that hump of being able to face it and live into a sense of transparency?
I would say a part of it is dipping their toes in. Mm-hmm. Just like with ice baths. Mm-hmm. That's where I am not here to hate on ice baths. It really is such an amazing metaphor for how it feels emotionally. Like you dip in for a minute. Maybe you can only do 30 seconds of the fear, right? And then it becomes completely overwhelming. But it's having enough tools and safety that you come out and then you wrap yourself in a towel and then you get a smoothie. You know?
Well, it's 90 seconds of showing yourself you can do hard things. And a lot of people don't know that, you know, it's a tough experience to do.
I learned it in the reverse. So I've been doing it emotionally my whole life because I had to, my soul took me to a place where if I'm going to be able to keep going, I have to find a way through all of the heavy shit that has been dropped on me. When I started doing ice baths, I was like, this is exactly the same.
I said the same thing. Yeah. Do you? Yeah.
Like it feels
It's like I'm just putting myself in a state of suffering. It's chosen suffering to realize, yeah. Oh, I can handle this, you know? Because everybody's trying to deal with the edges of what they can handle. An ice bath is kind of like knocking one of them down, you know? And say, yeah. Oh, God, I can do a little bit more than I think. And you can do that emotionally to say, okay, I've got this fear that I've been ignoring for 30 years. And I think I can finally face it. Just pick one. Mm-hmm. You know, one little thing. Like there's something last Tuesday that's still whirling in my brain. And I think learning that you can turn and face it is one of the most valuable skills I've ever found. Is just, yeah. And I think that pivot is to courage. So.
Yeah, to just, because nobody, like for me, when I want to go in that ice bath, like I don't really want to go.
Right. Nobody wants it. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to really go, but you know you're going to feel better afterwards.
Right.
And so then you drop in, like I have to kind of turn my head off for a second, drop in, turn my thoughts off. And then I'm, you know, because if you think you're just like, I want to get out of here. This is awful. Like that's what the mind is doing. Mm-hmm. And you have to find a way to work with that and turn it off to actually like take that. Okay, we're doing it. And so, you know, some people count, some people. You find your ways to cope through it. You know, the breath, mm-hmm. people do a lot of there are ways to, and it's the same. It's the same with our emotional world. When we're facing these things, it's like, okay, I know it's going to not be fun. It's going to be like, for a few minutes. And then I might end up feeling better. And that's the thing to know is that it's not, we're not doing it for no reason. It's not suffering in vain. Right? It's to be able to metabolize experiences. And that is something that not a lot of people, like I often get men, they're like, I didn't know therapy would help. And I'm like, how did you not know that? But like, they didn't think that, they just thought it was talking, right? They think it's just talking. And it's like, no, actually there's a way to do it where you're metabolizing your experiences, you're digesting them. And then it actually can clear the energy in a way that it's not heavy on you, mm-hmm. and you're not just carrying it around, you know, in your compartmentalized boxes. When I first got to therapy, after I had been through the ringer, I had been through what Francis Weller calls rough initiations, I told my therapist, maybe this is politically incorrect, I told my therapist I felt emotionally obese. Mm-hmm. And what I meant by that is I just had so many experiences I didn't know what to do with. Mm-hmm. I remember feeling like I was just hoarding experiences and I didn't know where they went or what they meant or how to feel about them. So I remember that mentality of being like, I don't even know where to start. And it can feel so overwhelming. So I love what you're saying, where it's just like, just pick one, pick one. Dip your toe in.
I want to go back to your article because you said the men's mental health crisis requires men to stop compartmentalizing and outrunning their feelings. What did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have met a lot of men who will do everything to not feel what they're feeling.
And so our audience understands, you are a crisis counselor.
I started that way. So okay. I've been working with
a lot of expertise in working with people that are at a crisis mode.
I my first gig in mental health was working in crisis for 5 years. I was working with people who are at their absolute edge. And like since then, I've worked in hospitals, I've worked nonprofits, I've worked all over the place, private practice. Yeah. So I have a lot of experience of people, either they're compartmentalizing and they're like, but it works for me. It's in a mm-hmm. box, nicely yes. in a box.
It works.
I put it in a shelf. It's mm-hmm. gone. Oof. So yeah, I've heard that a lot. And then I've heard the outrunning. They're just trying to keep busy. As long as they keep busy, as long as they have like full schedules and, you know, they go to the gym 5 times a week and everything, the dinners after, like they just pack their life. Then it's podcasts. Then I have all my podcasts. So they're never actually having space You know, then they fill it with, you know, we all have Netflix. We all have, you know, we find our ways to fill our energy and mind instead of turning inward. Yeah. So that's what I was meaning when I wrote that.
So that leads to this idea of tolerating momentary pain to transform what blocks the heart. That unpack that sentence, because it's not just about getting over the pain, it's about unblocking your heart. I don't think most men understand what it means to not have a block on their heart.
Yeah. And it's something, again, I feel so privileged that I have had the opportunity to support men in softening their hearts again and feeling again, because I know what a risk that can be, especially in this culture where there's so much fear, there's so much shame, it feels impossible. I know it can feel really impossible to be a man right now. And so, yeah, it's the purpose of, you know, like the ice bath, you dip your toes in. We're not just doing it in vain. The hope is that through this building of tolerance to the discomfort, we can actually get to what is blocking hearts. Like, what is the armor? What is the how many layers of protection where men can kind of operate in a way where they're not being fully authentic? They've got so many masks on because they feel they have to. They feel they have to please people or to keep being productive or keep being who they need to be for work, or, you know, keep up with all their roles and identities, that it is incredibly difficult to actually be authentic. And I have watched the horrible consequences of when they can't be. You know, marriages ending where they were never able to tell their partner the truth of how they felt. And so they became a zombie, in one case I'm thinking of, where someone became an absolute zombie in their marriage because they just stopped being able to feel at all.
Yeah.
And so then it just, the distance between the partners grew and grew and grew, and it wasn't able to work out because it just, they became such different people, and he was so far away from his heart, which thankfully now he's been able to reclaim and soften back into. But yeah, this is where it's such important work to be able to get back to our authentic, heartfelt living.
For our audience that's never done any kind of work like that, what does that work look like for you in terms of either in a clinical setting or in a workshop setting? How could men begin? What does it look like to kind of begin that process of doing work? What would you lead someone through if they came into your office?
Well, it would, again, first give them the tools to handle when discomfort arises. Because we're not going to be able to get very far if they get overwhelmed and the armor goes up immediately, right? So you have to really build that trust and give them a skill set to handle the discomfort, right? Like, just like the ice bath, the breath work, mindfulness, whatever it needs, whatever they need to feel safe. So the first, absolute first step is safety. Inner safety, right? It's outer and inner. It's the cultural messages and then the messages that we've absorbed so deeply that we think, like, we attack ourselves with them. We shame ourselves. Don't be weak. Ah, I don't want to feel this way. You know, like,
that's part of the problem is that most men feel anger and shame, or I don't know what a neutral setting would be, but anger and shame are constants in men's lives. And I think that's part of the reason is there's probably a lot of anger and shame, especially between fathers and sons and even mothers. I mean, there's definitely mother's wounds, but it's easier to compartmentalize and just kind of say it's not there. And here's the thing is for me, as I've done enough work with men and to have seen what kind of the way you finished your article was around when you're not afraid of your inner world, that is true power. And it's so interesting to see men become aware of their power because it's not egotistical. Mm-hmm. When you're taking care of yourself, it's not an egotistical power that needs attention. It's comfort and calm with the self, like to feel a sense of, oh, you know, when you remove all the noise from the signal, it plays beautiful music. That's kind of the metaphor or analogy that I would use is it's like all that negative energy is just noise to the signal. And if you remove it, you get to be the fullest expression of who you are.
I love that. And I use similar analogies in my work in terms of you end up just with this inner space. Like it's there, the voices are gone. Mm-hmm. And that's part of that building of inner safety. You end up, like you're saying, it's calm in there. It's not, and I love that you're differentiating these kinds of power because, yeah, a lot of men are taught power is control. Mm-hmm. Power, like there's all these toxic messages about what power is just money and having the best car and having a buff body. That's power. Having a bunch of people who want to date you, you know, right? And so it's reorienting that idea of what is true power. True power is when you feel peace inside of you, when you are able to just sit and feel calm and good and enjoy the present without the intrusive messages and being haunted by all the ghosts and all the thoughts and intrusive thinking and spinning thought. Like when all of that nervous system energy has settled and you have that, you know, if anything does arise, you know what's going on. Mm-hmm. That is power. Yeah, when you can get to a point where all these old patterns no longer haunt you. They might happen, like someone might try to activate you a certain way if you have a pattern with somebody. It doesn't hold the same power anymore. Yeah, you can just go back to that calm, beautiful space inside.
Why did you get into this type of work? Why crisis and why helping people go through this? What drew you to it?
Well, so actually what I specialize the most in is grief.
Oh, wow.
Nobody likes talking about that one. So that's actually what I do specialize in. But what got me into the field is I had been through the ringer. I'd had my own rough initiations and I did not feel equipped. I was like, I will need to understand what is going on here. What I put on my scientist hat from a young age, and I got very curious about what was going on in my life, what was going on with everyone, how are all these people who love each other hurting each other? What is going on here? We're all in pain.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. I have the same story. Yeah.
A lot of us do, right? And for me, it was I wanted to figure this out deeply. Yeah. And so I was fascinated with psychology and sociology, which is really important because it was both doing the microscopic exploration and the macro of like these larger forces at play. So I carry both. My PhD is in public health, actually. So I have been on this journey of building what I sometimes joke I'm a cartographer of hell. Like I'm just building a map, just like creating this giant map.
Right. Yeah, no, I know.
You hear me.
It's interesting that in life, when it brings you a very deep sense of suffering, like I played a victim for so long and I realized being a victim is easier, but harder in the long run. It's easier in the short run and it's harder in the long run because it becomes extremely tiring. Mm-hmm. And I realized right around my 20s, I started saying, you know what? I need help. Like I am a basket case. And and I really began to seek out help, but I didn't have any clue where I was going. I just started listening to really smart people that seemed like they were going in the direction that I wanted to go. And so, but it sounds like you had a similar journey of just trying to figure it out for your own sake, because that's why I did.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I thought I had, especially in the crisis distress center world, I thought I'd figured a lot of it out because I'd been trained on every topic in mental health. And then I went through my first major death experience.
Personal or for a client?
It was someone I loved.
Okay.
Died pancreatic cancer. And it just shook me. Everything I thought I knew went out the window. Grief was like, I was humbled. I was just so humbled. Everything I theoretically knew no longer applied. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to figure that out because it was just such a potent energy that all of a sudden I looked around. I was like, oh my gosh, I've been grieving my whole life. I had no idea that this is grief that I've been feeling. And so that led me down an even wilder path of the PhD and the research I've done. And but it's something that I specialize
in. Can you unpack what grief is from a clinical standpoint, but also maybe from your own personal perspective? Because grief, it sounds like it's distinct to you. And I want to draw that distinction out.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it again fits with our dipping our toes in this ice bath, because grief is one of these very hard things to allow. But grief is multifaceted, and it's an embodied response to loss. Mm-hmm. So there has to be some kind of attachment to what's been lost. Otherwise, we won't feel it. If we don't attach to something or somebody, we won't feel the loss of them. So it really is about the nature of the attachment. And it's this embodied physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, like it's a full experience that's where I was so humbled. And I see the power of it because it's, again, it's not something that's just for no reason. It's very adaptive and it helps us digest what's happened in our lives. So it's one of these powerful forces like the ice bath. That if we can grow more tolerance for, there is such medicine in it and such healing and power. If we can, I could go on ad nauseum about this.
No, I think that's part of why I invited you on, is because I think personally, I study my own internal world a lot. I journal heavily, but I also am very conscious of the world around me. And I think we have entered, especially with the introduction of AI, because AI is freaking a lot of people out. Politically, the world is interesting. Money-wise is interesting. There's a lot of things just kind of on fire right now. And I think people are beginning to realize, how am I going to survive through this? I can barely afford to live. How am I going to survive? And in order to truly survive long-term, you got to have connection to your heart. And I think people are beginning to really say, I need help here. And we're realizing this is a response to something going on here that I think at a core, people have to learn how to love themselves. I mean, that's at a very core level. You only deal with yourself 24/7. Everybody else gets a pass. And so if you can't live with yourself, you can't live with anybody. And I think the attachment part is who we think we are. Mm-hmm. And when we lose someone, we're trying to make sense of what does it mean? What does life mean without this person? And how do you help people through that process? Because I know grief is a 5-stage process, but how do you help people through that?
So I'm going to first just respectfully disagree on the 5 stages. It is not.
I am glad you say that.
Okay. I'm busting.
That's a common model, but help inform us. Give us better information.
Yes. So better information here. There are no 5 stages of grief. There are no stages of grief. There is no one right way. There's so many toxic, unhelpful, harmful messages that actually keep us shame in our shame about grief. because then we're like, the number one.
I should be in one of the stages. Yeah.
I'm doing it wrong. So yeah, the number one question I get is, right, am I doing grief right? That is and infused in that question is shame.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It's its engine.
The relationship between grief and shame in our culture, because it's the culture that's shaping the space for our grief to come out. Because one of the big things that I love sharing and I find is just very powerful is grief is a mammal activity. It's not just...
Unpack that.
So all mammals grieve.
Yeah.
All mammals grieve. We are not this random, unique species grieving. All mammals grieve. So to think we are somehow above it, or that we can just push it somewhere, is not helpful. It's not it should be the most natural, normal thing that if you go through a loss, that you have a grief response. Like, you could look at a BBC Earth, I believe, like they've written up on this, like they could talk about the rituals done by giraffes and elephants and different sizes of mammals. And I say all this to destigmatize grief. Like, we want to destigmatize it because it's something that, again, a lot of us are just like an ice bath. We're like, this is awful. I don't want to do it. Why would I do this?
Right.
It feels illogical to allow the pain of grief to happen when I'm supposed to be happy.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not supposed to feel this way.
How do you help people kind of step into grief is that space where you let the heart take over and feel it. How do you help people kind of enter into that?
Well, again, so this is where we want to clear out these toxic cultural programs, all these messages that keep us blocked from being able to drop in. So there's this a lot of clearing and correcting of problematic messaging. And then once that space is cleared, we can then, it's actually a do less experience. It's an allow. It's an allowing. And I love sharing. We already know how to grieve in our creature, our mammal self. Our bodies know what to do. We hijack the process mentally. So especially when we think of, you know, we've talked about with men being way more cerebral, way more, you know, they're proud of their advancements in logic and reason. You could get just stuck in the head. You get stuck there. I used to be this way. Like, I'm an academic. I know how to be smart and cut off. I know how to think that I'm just from the neck up and that I don't have a body. And then I've also experienced the problems of cutting off from my body. But when we can actually relax the mind and allow the body to do its magic, to do what it knows how to do. That's it. We want to move people there. And I've had to do a lot of work with men to assure them that when grief that comes in waves, the waves, you know, can be overwhelming. They can crash over us. They do stop. You get breathers. They're not just like relentless waves.
It does end.
Yeah. Well, and it subsides, like maybe another round of waves, just like the weather, you know, like we can't predict the weather.
Right.
But no weather is permanent. Like, it's just not. It keeps evolving. And
I've studied a lot about pain, and human beings can adapt to their capacity to experience pain. And actually, what's the most painful part of the origination of the pain is your imagination of it, not the actuality of it. And so you get into this idea, this is going to hurt. And that's your body practicing the rehearsal before it happens, and you're feeling it. And that's what a lot of people don't realize. The imagination they bring to it adds tremendously to the experience of the actual pain. And when you let it go, you're realizing, one, we have the capacity to let it go. We create the attachment. And I like how you said it's the attachment leaving But you got to let it go, because grief is realizing, okay, I'm a better human. I'm still okay if I let it go. That's the hard part, is it's that over that arc of what does it mean to let go of whatever this that I'm grieving over? And that is a very hard journey for people because of the level of attachment. I've been very I think this conversation around attachment over the last 3 to 5 years has been extremely valuable, because we're learning how our body does it automatically. It's just, it's how we're operating. And, you know, grief, you see that loss, that attachment process almost on fire.
Well, and it depends on what the grief is about, because some things are easier to let go of than others. Like, and some things are ripped out of our hands, or the attachments are just, you know, with a sudden death, for example, that is just shocking to the body. It feels so unfair and unjust to the body when it's sudden and unpredictable. So like, there's that kind of heaviness, but then there's, you know, a loss of a relationship or a friendship or a shirt or a, you know, like, like it depends on what was lost and what we can do as we move through. Like, we have to allow the grief to kind of ripple through us, to kind of shock our systems and move, digest it. Cause it is hard. We don't want to let go. Letting go is maybe the hardest thing.
Right.
It's maybe one of the hardest. So we're talking like the most cold ice baths right now.
Yeah. This sucks. The first, it's like the first ice bath. You don't even know how bad it's going to be. And then it's like shocking. You know, because Rich does ice baths a lot, and my co-host, and he said, you know, when you start, it's like getting in, it's like, oh, it takes like 5 minutes just to get in. And then, you know, you realize by the third time, just get in. You know, it's like, get over that. And then you learn, oh, you can get over it. And I think that's, it's got to be a very rewarding part, seeing people get over their own fears and, and their own griefs. Essentially, because grief is very personal.
Yeah. And it's not that we ever get over grief. And for some people, they don't get over it. So some people, like if you lose a child, or if you lose a partner, you're not trying to get over it. There's no end point. There's no end necessarily. It's not about, one of the big theories in the field is it's continuing bonds. And so it's more about transforming the type of relationship that it was, the type of attachment that it was. Because maybe they're not in the physical presence anymore, but how can you still keep a connection? So it's not a clean cut in some cases with grief, or finding some perfect end. That's why there's no stages. Because what we have to do is allow, we have to allow its process to work through us. And this is where it's so hard. A lot of people don't want to allow the anger, because grief is all sorts of things. Grief is anger. So when we talk about anger with men, I love also, here's another myth to bust, that underneath anger is grief.
I agree with that. Yeah.
And that was big for me. I was like, really? Because it looks so different. But once you really, you know, once this act of like, but something has been lost. Something is unjust. Right? Like some boundary was crossed, something was, you know, there's something going on there that is a grief of some form. And so when you are able to know that, you can work with it differently. And I, when the people, so one thing I really noticed, I want to say is, I've really noticed the people who don't digest their feelings versus the people who do. And you were talking about how rewarding it is.
Digest
it. When they are able to actually digest and metabolize grief or these heavy experiences.
Let it flow through them. Is that what you're saying?
Let it flow through you. It changes you.
Yeah. Because you're allowing your body to experience what it's meant to experience. And then it flows out of you. It's the resistance. The attachment creates the resistance that creates the heat in the signal, which creates the chaos. And if you just let it go through, you realize, oh, I can handle the emotion. Yeah, I'm sorry. I just took a little tangent there, but it's like, that's the experience. It has to flow through you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you have to find your grounding for it. Mm-hmm. And that's where the safe containers are so yeah. important. But what I'm also adding to this is that it will change you. So for example, let's say you are slowly learning someone you thought was a friend is not a friend. Mm-hmm. You're starting, if you refuse to feel the feelings of like, hey, that what they just did was kind of mean, or that didn't feel, you know, like if you refuse to feel that, that is how you stay their friend. That is how you're like, it's fine. Really, your body's like, this is not, like, I'm cringing. Like, I'm like feeling a little sick in my stomach. Like, I don't really want to see them anymore. Like, that starts building. And if you digest that, if you digest the hurt of like, hey, actually, they're not really seem to care about me at all. When you really digest that, you change. Mm-hmm. And you change. So this is where I mean, like, these things can change us when we digest them.
And then digestion in that sense feels like it's just coming to terms with reality.
It's integrating it, like, in all the parts.
Right.
That mental, emotional, spiritual, all of these parts, the physical, the body is now in alignment with the mind. Mm-hmm. And saying, this isn't good for us. This is no longer serving us. We don't really want to be doing this anymore. You know, like, that's when we have these integrated. It's not just the mind being like, but they're our friend and we have a history. And, you know, because they can be at odds, the body and the mind.
And so I have a pet theory about that. And it's a growing theory because I digest these ideas all the time. Is humanity is realizing, I think men lived in history primarily up here, and we've been in a masculine age controlled by the head. And women have lived primarily here. And I think what's happening is this emergence of a coherence where women are waking up to what's going on up here and men are beginning to wake up here. And it's creating a sense of balance that people can say, okay, because the value of having both is a sense of coherence. Your body's meant to tell you when it's hurting. And if you've compartmentalized it, you can't even feel the pain anymore. And that's hard. So it's coming to terms with, we're gaining both capacities on a much more robust level. Men are realizing, I can feel. That's not just female. It's feminine energy, but it's not just female. Both of us can have that. And women are saying, oh, I like the masculine and I can have that too. It's like you were an academic focusing here, but you learned I had to come out here. And having both creates a much more balanced life. That's my theory.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting theory.
But we're waking up, that humanity is beginning to wake up, that I need both.
Well, and it's actually, I mean, technically, from a neuroscience perspective, it's all up here in terms of I'm pointing at my head for those who can't see. The back of the head is where we store our trauma. And it's known to be, and this is my like brain 101, because it took me forever to figure this out. But I've taught it to my daughter. The back of the head is where we store our trauma and our memories. And so that's where we can have these highly emotional experiences that we can't put our fingers on. Like, it's just, and the goal is to get the prefrontal cortex, the front of the head, online. That is the battle for a lot of people when they're triggered in their trauma or in their nervous systems, because nervous system science is one of the most popular right now in terms of like, and I don't know in terms of gender or energies how this all aligns, but it to be able to get the clear thinking of the prefrontal cortex is such a battle when we're triggered with our trauma memories. Yeah.
Where do you think the experience of when you say you're in your body resides?
Well, I have learned now. So I used to think that I was going to be cursed in my anxiety, in my nervous system for the rest of my life. I just thought it was now the water it was the water I swam in for years, for decades. It was just having a more hypervigilant spinning mind. And it was life-changing to do somatic work, and that's work with the body. to find other, to actually allow the mind to rest, to recognize that a spinning mind is the back of the brain on fire. Like it's, you know, you're activated in fight or flight, or even in, so I don't know if you know this, like the ladder of regulation, where it's like at the very bottom, we're in dorsal mode of this ladder. We're collapsed. We're just completely overwhelmed, deer in headlights. And that is when we're just, things that we have no tolerance for what we're going through. If we can climb up the ladder, this is Deb Dana, by the way. If in the middle of the ladder is fight or flight. So that's an active energy. That means we've been able to climb out of deer in headlights and are able to do something. Fight or flight, run away, you know, fight whatever's happening. And then at the top of the ladder is ventral mode. And that's when we can feel safe with other people. It's when we have other, we're feeling connected, we're feeling good. The thing with this ladder is we climb up and down it all the time, every day. The goal is to be able to keep moving up. And we can't just stay at the top of the ladder. That would be impossible. It's recognizing we can actually find our way out of the collapsed state. Maybe we need to do some fight or flight. Then how do we reconnect with people? So it's learning where you're at on the ladder, learning what to do about it. But so with the body, yeah, like the body is powerful. The body actually is your best ally. And I don't mean it in a feminine energy way. I mean it in a, just a mammal way. In like, the body tells us the truth. The body has been with us our whole lives. It's been like our best friend. Yeah, it's our best friend.
And I don't think a lot of people realize that that signal is what helps us navigate life really well.
Mm-hmm. And I will say the men that I have worked with are often so taken aback as they continue to pay attention to their bodies. Because as we've talked, it's men, you know, it's beyond emotions. Emotions, so when I talk about emotions, I am talking about them like they're just symptoms of things happening. Just like we would talk about having cold symptoms. Like they are not right or wrong. At all. It's not about right or wrong with feelings. They are just, you know, it's like, oh, you have a cough and a sniffle. That's probably this. You have a this and a this. You have anger and shame. That's this. It's a predictor.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really predictable patterns going on with our feelings, and we don't choose them. It's just what happened creates feelings in us. They're not the truth. They're just symptoms of things. They can point us in directions. They can cue us to understand what's going on in our lives. And so again, maybe this is a part of why I'm thinking this is important, is it's not necessarily feminine. These are just things. These are just human thing capacities that we can all work with. Is we can work with figuring out these patterns in our feelings or in our thoughts or in our behaviors. We can start seeing them for what they are and figuring out what's going on in our nervous systems and seeing our body as our best ally. And so when men come back into sessions with me, they'll often be like, my body told me a thing and it was right. And my body responded first, my instinct. Like when you've done this work to get back in your body, it's amazing what it will tell you. It's amazing. Like it's such a powerful tool.
Yes.
And I think not just thoughts.
Well, I think in terms of everyday life, if you hate your job and you're not sure your wife even wants you in the house and your kids don't pay attention anymore, so it's like you've compartmentalized all those feelings, you've missed those signals because you've kind of numbed your body. And I think that's the trap most men fall in.
Yes. Absolutely. And I also know on this thread is a lot of men are afraid of those cues.
What do you mean by that?
So they're afraid of like, so in response to the article, we've had, we had a whole variety of responses, but one guy was like, I feel a beast inside me would emerge and just wreak havoc on my life. And I think that resonates with a lot of men. A lot of men are like, whoa, I have been compartmentalizing this for 30, 40 years. If I start feeling again, I don't even know what will happen.
Right. Yeah. And then you go back to the old adage, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I think, you know, we can. That's the thing. I'm 57 and I've probably changed half of my life over the last year and a half. It's possible. We just don't believe it's possible. Neuroplasticity is very real and it's very valuable because that's our makeup. That's actually our biology.
Yes. Yeah. And I love that. And I love carving these new brain pathways. Mm-hmm. It is so possible to rewire. And that's even why I loved when you were your Matrix podcast. Because it is kind of like the Matrix in how you can recode. Mm-hmm. You can replace old codes with new codes.
Yeah.
It's that. And so that is when you've asked, like, how do I work with men? That is one of the things we're doing. We're taking out old codes that no longer serve. Like they probably were put in, you know, if they were put in the 90s or the 80s, it was like mm-hmm. a completely different technology back then.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, this code is actually blocking the heart. This code's actually just making you self-sabotage. It's mm-hmm. it's unnecessary. And it's how do we update these codes? How do we keep doing program updates? So you're at the latest technologies of yourself.
And going back, you know, because I know you're not bashing IcePass. No. You're suggesting just don't stop there. That's the key is, but IcePass are sort of a very quick way to realize, to challenge yourself, to say, can I do something hard? Because I think that's what a lot of men today are really searching for is, you know, is this it? Can I do something harder? And I think men are waking up to wanting more of that new life rather than just being sedated by the old. I want to switch gears for a second because you brought it up. From your perspective, what did you think of the Matrix? Because we started this podcast out of a conversation like that. What captured you about the Matrix?
I very much resonated with the socialization into a world that you can be awakened from.
Mm-hmm.
That you can then
love it.
Yeah, you wake up and you're like, what the, like, I had someone say to me the other day, they're like, I would have been the guy who would have wanted to stay in the Matrix. It's like, that guy, you mean the guy who like betrayed his friends and got them killed? Like, what are we talking about? Like, it's always better to be that person to wake up to see reality. Mm-hmm. I'm committed to wanting to know the reality as close as I can possibly get to it, mm-hmm. to be as strong as possible in it, to have my map, my cartographer of hell map, because I feel so much stronger for it. And so that's what I love about the Matrix is we can have, and Neo does this, I think I don't remember which one, when he finally gets it, right? When it finally all clicks for him and he can see the codes in front of him. I actually cried watching that scene, rewatching it from my version of myself at this age. I'm almost 40. But from this point of view where it's like the codes were just in front of him and he's like, I get it now. And he was just like calmly, like, you know, and he fights and he's like bored and he's... He stops the bullet and he's just like, that is true power. When you see these codes, when you see what's going on here and you know what to do, that's again, maybe a visual, that scene in the movie of what deep power is.
If you were a character in the movie, who are you? I'm curious what you pick. We ask this of a lot of our guests. If you're one of the characters, who are you?
And if it doesn't matter, you'd be anybody.
No, yeah. You could be anybody. Yeah.
I am Neo. Good. I am Neo.
I would imagine you would have picked that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did Neo stand out to you?
Well, I have gone through so many rounds of these initiations, mm-hmm. these rough initiations where half the time you're like, what is happening? What is this? You know, you're not sure where it's going. And you're building your capacities as you go. Because, yeah, one of the big themes is he's like, am I here to figure this out? Like, he's questioning often. Yeah. And that is a really common, beautiful hero's journey. You know, is to go through these periods of doubt and trying to, you know, trusting. You're trusting the path. And then you finally mm-hmm. get there. And You're like, oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, like I can do it. And that's where it's, now that I am someone who's gotten, I have gone through, I can't even tell you the amount of suffering, the amount of pain. I'm a tiny person. If I can do it, anyone can. If I can do it, anyone can. And so that's where I just feel so passionate about wanting people to have the same kind of freedom that I have now known possible. That is the message. There are ways to heal. There is freedom to be had and peace to be had. And if I can do it, anyone can.
You said your journey started around 9. Is that when you said?
Age 9?
Yeah, when you really started listening to what was happening in your life. Is that when you started?
Oh, no. I mean, I was born just one of these sensitive souls.
Oh, you were.
Yeah.
If you were to look back at yourself in those sort of one of the really hard moments where you just could only survive through, what would you say back to that person? To you yourself back then? What would you say?
I would say, well done. Like, well done. And I'm not saying that because I handled it perfectly, because I did, you know, some beautiful job. Like it was rough and I was surviving, and well done for getting through. And so that's where I have so much empathy for people who shut down, people who go numb. Mm-hmm. We have to get through those phases.
Especially sensitive souls. And I think that's one of the most valuable things that I learned probably last year. A mentor helped me see that is, it's okay to just be completely lost. Mm-hmm. The survival act was enough. You got through. That's it. You did your job. And guess what? It was my job to learn later, but learning that I could go back to my 12-year-old self, because I just went to Hawaii with my wife and I didn't realize I went back to the location. I had been there in 28 years where we went as a family through my parents' divorce, and I was able to sit with myself on the beach strand as the waves were crashing on me. And it was just a very healing moment to realize you survived. And I cried. I cried very significantly because I realized, man, I had left so much pain on that beach, and I could sit with myself and go, you did your job. And I think most people don't realize they can do that. They can go back and actually change the story, because you can't change the event, but you can change your assessment of yourself in the event.
Mm-hmm. And you can rewrite the ending. You can.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't have to end where you think the memory ends.
Yes.
There can be a new ending, a reclaimed ending that is so much better than you can imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that story. And I have very similar ideas of how this, like, I am always being revisited and revisiting whatever arises. And this is that whole not being afraid of what's inside of you.
Because your body will tell you when it's ready to let it go, it'll tell you. And I think if you're not listening for the signal, then it's hard to hear it. So and then it'll kind of bash you upside the head and say, hey, wait a minute, listen. Because that's my own self-sabotage techniques were always me trying to tell myself, I'm not addressing something, I'm not listening to something, and kind of waking up to that. What did you think? Because I know you're Neo, and that was exactly who I thought you'd pick. What do you think of Trinity as a character? Because Trinity, I think, is the biggest badass.
Do you?
Yeah.
What do you think? Well, I mean,
she's the first character introduced. And what we see is she's the antithesis of what we think a traditional female model or role model is. She's both masculine and feminine. She's kicking ass. She's taking names, and she knows who she is. Mm-hmm. And I think she's sort of the hero because she inspires Neo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mind went to she is way more self-assured.
Mm-hmm.
She's very. There's no question in her mind what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's the version we all aim for. We all love to be Trinity that way. You know, I'm more of a fumbling, bumbling my way through suffering versus, but then now when you get to that point, I mean, Neo joins her in that.
And that's what I mean. She's the hero because she inspires him to move up, to believe in love.
Yeah.
Essentially. And I think that's why people, when people look at that movie, we had a gentleman that we interviewed and he picked Trinity. And I said, that's awesome because she is the hero of the story. She is the one who got it right. And she's the inspirer and she's the energy of the movie. And I think for women looking at that movie going, well, I don't, you have the most badass character. Mm-hmm. You really do. Neo had to kind of come around to get it. She got it from the very beginning. So.
Very few of us.
That's what I loved about it. What's that?
Said very few of us are born that way.
Yes, very true. Very, very true. It's something to aspire to. So, Prima, what are you doing now?
In my work?
Yes. Are you writing any more articles? Is this something you do? Because I was inspired by the article. Is that something you're doing regularly?
It's something I'm moving into. So I finished a PhD that took me 8 years. And now I'm coming back in to share my work. And so I'm writing another, Mark and I are writing another article right now. So look for it. It's actually about the beast within men. So
really? Tell me what's the synopsis?
The synopsis is we do a bit of a deep dive into the story of Iron John. Do you know the story?
Oh my God, that's one of my favorite books. My mentor introduced me to that 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, I totally,
yeah. Yeah, so we go on that.
Snatching the key under the mom's pillow is one of the arcs of human, most males, yes.
Yes.
Most people don't even know that story. So if you're listening to this, go find this article because Iron John is a seminal men's book. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is not like, I don't even know these. I just kept getting handed like James Hollis and different things. So I'm doing more deep dives of like what's going on in the wounding of men. But again, my specialty is grief. My specialty is grief. So I'm going to be like, I'm publishing in academic journals and I'm speaking at conferences, but I am also doing like this men's wounding. I love men. I'm very passionate about this. It's complicated. It's so complicated. And I love that you're doing this podcast. I love that you're having these conversations. Mm-hmm. That inspires me to know that like these spaces are being created to have hard conversations. And dip in to the ice baths emotion.
Karima, it's been an absolute pleasure having you. I have loved this hour because I think one of the things that we are very passionate about is helping people, not just men, but people find ways to overcome. And I think everybody can really learn from you today because just the act of listening, turning around and finding your courage to look at your compartmentalized stuff is very valuable because, as I always say on a lot of my Instagram stuff, is when you let it go, you have a lot more energy and that's your true power. And so thank you for clarifying a lot of that for us and really helping us see it's sort of a simple progression. So this has been fantastic. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So to everyone who's listening, Rich will be back next week and please comment and review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a guest you'd like us to interview, please send them our way. Much love, everybody.